going to take a look at the shocking story of Wisconsin's most notorious killers, and that's really almost the title of the book. The title of the book is Got Murder, and the subtitle is The Shocking Story of Wisconsin's Notorious Killers. Our guest is Martin Hintz of Milwaukee. He's written and contributed to more than 50 books, including the America the Beautiful series, Wisconsin Portraits, Wisconsin Sports Heroes, and Minnesota Family Weekends. And his latest book is Got Murder. So really pleased to have him with us today. And certainly you can join in with your questions and comments as we go along here, talking about the famous names you're going to remember, or you're going to recognize a lot of those names as we move along today and visit with him. Certainly, if you have a question or a comment about any of these, or maybe a question of your own about a murder that you may or may know a little about, but want to know a little more, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Martin, welcome.
Well, good morning and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you as well. Seems like a good day to talk about your book.
Well, I'm scared to death.
Right. I tell you, how did you happen to decide to write this book?
Well, I've had a lot of work with Trails Publishing, which is a Madison-based company, yeah. And it's affiliated with Big Earth Publishing, which is a major publisher out here in the Midwest. And since I had done a number of books for them previously, they asked if I'd tackle this particular subject. And it took about a year and a half to kind of assemble it and kind of choose who we were going to feature and highlight, mm-hmm. and of course some of the big names, and we'll get into them in a second, and just try to give an overview of Wisconsin, our cheese state that sometimes has a bit of a dark side to it.
And we really have some notorious characters, killers in this state, don't we?
Well, yeah, but you don't really have to be totally afraid. It's a lot of other states have just as grim a scene, too, and other countries. And I just read in the paper just yesterday that this Russian murderer was killed sent to prison for killing about 60-some people, and he wanted to match the number of pieces on a chessboard. So he almost got to the 64, and they finally caught him. And so we're not the only ones here, so we don't have to be really scared that they're running up and down, ramping up and down university out here or anything like that.
Well, I would hope not. And maybe just to tick off some of the name. Well, as I look at your cover of your book, there are some of the most notorious guys. And so it's not all guys. There's some women involved, too.
Well, there were, but the definition, we tried to cover we started out, we just do serial killers, and we thought, well, we could do 7 or 8 volumes on that, and thought, oh, we better tone that back. And then kind of thought, let's put in some mass murderers, and we had quite a few of those characters. And then it got down to, some other individual slayers. But to kind of do a little bit of a back pedal here, the book is not just simply for wild times and scary reading. Mm-hmm. It's dedicated to the victims.
Yeah.
And we have to remember, in all of this, somebody's sister, somebody's daughter, somebody's son, father, cousin, and it's a serious side to it, too. And the introductory part of the book, before we get into Ed Gein and Jeffrey Dahmer and David Allen Van Dyke and some of these other characters, we talk a little bit about maybe why people do this and the whole, why people kill, why people are serial killers and why are mass murderers. And I've talked to psychologists and doctors and wardens and police about that. So there's a lot of issues that kind of bubble up.
What happens in the mind? Why, take a serial killer? How does a person become a serial, or why?
Well, for every individual serial killer, there's a reason. And unfortunately, even though, most of them are white men. Mm-hmm. And rarely would you find an African-American, an Hispanic, an Asian individual. You might find an occasional woman, but usually that's a woman who might murder her own family rather than lashing out against somebody in the broad community. Kind of what we found, the FBI definition of a serial killer is somebody usually kills at least 3 people. And now they're kind of fudging and say maybe 2. Now, like Ed Gein only killed two people. I shouldn't say only killed. He killed two people, but he desecrated graves and was kind of a little bit earned his notoriety through that. So therefore, he makes the gruesome list, the top of the charts, kind of, where Dahmer did in 16 people, at least in the state, and at least one in Ohio that we know of. So you could say that three and above is the general criteria for a serial killer. Now, a mass murderer would be somebody who just for whatever reason goes out and slays a number of people in a restaurant, kills them in a church like in Brookfield in 2005. Mm-hmm. One of the congregation members had some challenges, and he just took it out on everybody around him. Chai Vang, the hunter in the North Woods, was confronted by other hunters, and whatever happened in those woods stays in the woods, and unfortunately several bodies stayed there too, so he wound up killing people. And they talked about rage control and potentially his background as a soldier or coming as a out of the highlands of mm-hmm. Vietnam War and all that might have made somebody do something. And Gain, we can talk all sorts of things about his mother and
all sorts of things.
We'll get all the calls from mothers now, I'm sure, but there are a lot of these issues per personality.
Yeah. Chris in Green Bay has a question for you. Chris, hello.
Hi. I'm calling about when I was about, I want to say maybe four, maybe five, there was a lady in Appleton who had diced up her husband, and she had been taking parts of him and leaving him all over the city, and it kind of held the city in, I don't want to say terror, but it held an interest for at least a few weeks, and I was wondering whatever happened to that lady.
Well, I'm sure she's incarcerated since we don't have a death penalty in the state, and I don't know whether she'd be in Tichita or where they might have taken her, or to one of the secure mental institutions. People just don't she's trying to pull herself together, I guess, but I'm not familiar with that particular case.
No.
But there's a lot of individual murders that we weren't able to get into the book.
Yeah, and when I'm thinking about your story about Jeffrey Dahmer as an example, when you're talking about mental institutions, I think his attorneys were trying to get him placed into a mental institution, and of course that didn't work out that way at all.
No, because you have to you could have an insane plea, but you have to know right from wrong, and you may be pretty goofy. But the court will determine whether you knew right from wrong, whether or not you should be in prison as criminally insane. And that wasn't the case in this. And Dahmer admitted it. He finally surprised even his own attorney when at the very last minute he decided to cop a guilty plea. And that's why he was sent to prison. And they didn't prove that he was insane or not, even though he probably had a lot of questions. His lawyer kept saying, "This is the most lonely man I've ever met." He just had no friends, and even as a youngster, he was quite shy and kind of picked on, and it's no excuse to lash out like that, but the word was he would lure these young men into his spider web, which it kind of was, and when they wanted to leave, you can't go, bang, so he'd pop them, and that's kind of the reason, has been given a number of times, is he just had some psychological need to be with people, and he took it out in the wrong way.
Mark in Bayfield, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
This interesting topic, and I thought about this tiny little town in Bayfield and how 3 years ago we had a murder up here, and nobody's been held accountable still yet for it. Kind of like wondering, you know, I guess that's murders around, but you never find out who it was. So you can never.
And it's got to be a terrible thing for the families.
Right. You know, there are quite a few unsolved murders. In fact, here in Madison, there's eight or nine from the late 60s to the 1980s of young ladies who were killed, and they never found their murderer. And it leaves a hole in the heart, and there's no closure. And I can really identify with the sadness that a family would have. And I'm sure that your authorities up there are still looking. These files just don't close. And sometimes a determined detective, a police officer, always on alert, just might find something that hey, this is something I remember from a few years ago, and somewhere they can bring the person to justice even years later. So they're always looking, always looking.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, Mark. Jared in West Allis, your turn now. Hi, Jared.
Oh, hi. I was wondering if your guest has done any research as far as profiles into the families that these various types of killers come from. As a kind of casual observer of this phenomena, it seems to me that serial killers tend to come from dysfunctional families, but mass murderers tend to come from, as far as we can tell, relatively decent families. Like Tim McVeigh was from a relatively decent family. You know, he was a mass murderer. Jeffrey Dahmer was from a dysfunctional family, and perhaps even Osama bin Laden could be considered from a decent family also. So I was wondering if you've done any research on that, or if that kind of casual observation, you know, is true.
Well, that gets back to semantics, I think, and what's decent and what isn't, and each family has to make their own choices. For instance, back to that Ed Gein case, his mother was quite well known to be overbearing, and George, her husband, was an alcoholic, and she really kind of ran him down quite a bit, and he eventually died. And Augusta Gein raised her two sons, Henry and Ed, by herself. They moved from La Crosse to Plainfield to protect them from the sins of La Crosse, I guess. So maybe a parental unit there had her own issues. And the one other part of the family, the father wasn't able to stand up to that. So probably you could say that's quite dysfunctional, but a lot of people can rise above that. So you can't just say a dysfunctional family causes this, or I don't think you can say a decent family, everybody's going to turn out well, and of course they don't. But people are responsible for their own actions, I think.
Yeah. Thank you, Jared, for calling. Appreciate your call. Martin Hintz, our guest today from Milwaukee, he's written a lot of books, over 50 books, and or contributed to more than 50 books, including the America Beautiful series. And his latest book is Got Murder. It's published by Trails Books. You can join in with your questions, too, at 1-800-642-1234, in Madison at 263-1890, or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about some of Wisconsin's most notorious killers right now, and visiting with Martin Hintz, who is author of the book Got Murder. It's published by Trails Books. I'm pleased to have him along on this Halloween day. If you have a question for him, please feel free to join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. 263-1890. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us a call or an email, and we'll be glad to take up your question or your comment. And Martin, we mentioned Jeffrey Dahmer, and People magazine called him one of the 100 most intriguing personalities of the 20th century. And intriguing, I don't know if it's a if that's an appropriate word for him.
Well, that is a kind of an interesting phrase, I guess. So was Joseph Stalin, kind of intriguing, and other characters like that, Osama bin Laden, you know, if you kind of dig deep enough into all this. But I can see where they could say that, because they become almost an icon, a negative icon, but an icon nonetheless, and they become the benchmark in which other people kind of look at, in this case, the serial killer. But there's Ted Bundy, and there's other people like that that were just as gruesome in the way they operated. Intriguing, yeah. Incredible what they do, yeah. It's just, if you can use all those I words. Scary, yes.
Scary, yes, for sure. Alex in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Alex, hi. Thank you for calling.
To the guest, great show. I just have an Ed Gein related story. My parents came to this country from the former Soviet Union. It's odd you should invoke Stalin just a moment or two ago. And they survived the totality of World War II, came to New York, and then came to this wild place called Wisconsin, to Washera County, and to Plainfield. And one of the very first people they met is Ed Gein. And my mother and father did not speak English at that time, at least not very well. And my mother shared with me that she would spend, she said that she would spend hours with Ed. And he would talk and talk and talk. And my mother did not understand what he was saying, but he was apparently quite a talker. A friendly guy, befriended my mother and father. My mother, though, had a hypothesis, and she thought that because Ed was psychotically obsessed with his mother and therefore with older women, she was just too young for him at that time. And I was just wondering what the guest's opinion of that was. I'll listen on air. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Interesting hypothesis, and maybe true, because the graves that he desecrated were mostly middle-aged to older women, mostly people that he knew of in the community. And that's what scared or shook up people so much around that area. Everybody knew Ed. He was a handyman. He babysat for kids. He went hunting with the neighborhood. He was a farmer in a sense. He wasn't. He lived mostly on subsidies, I think, but and deer hunting and all that. And like everyone else up there, he had his shotguns and rifles because his hunting was quite the culture, and augmented his livelihood with that. But he was well known around town, and people thought, well, he might be a little peculiar, but he was the town character. And when it was uncovered that he had actually killed these two women, and that was quite the shock. And, of course, double shock when it found out that he had desecrated all these 12 or so graves and dug up the bodies and things. And people said, how could it happen here? It can't happen here. And you hear these stories all the time when there is a tragedy in a community. Well, it never happens in my neighborhood, but then unfortunately it does, because there is somebody just might have a side to them that you don't realize. It's always – I shouldn't say that – sometimes the calm, quiet personality has a lot of rage or something underneath them. Like the Ted Bundy character was quite suave and sophisticated, and he'd meet up with these young ladies all over the country and do them in. But he was slick, and was nobody would suspect him. And they finally they'd get caught, naturally. But and the same with Ed. He was just meek, unassuming, mild, and sometimes a chatterbox. So other people have said he was quiet. So your mom probably was able to elicit kind of a good response out of him.
Thanks, Alex, for calling. Robert, I believe, has something about Ed Gein, too. Robert, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, guys. I'm calling on the cell phone driving, so I'll make it quick. How many people do they think that, following up on your last question there, how many people do they think that Ed Gein might have killed other than the two, if they think he may have killed others? And can you explain what the sheriff found when he actually got to his house? Thanks, guys. I'll listen off the air.
All right, thank you for calling.
It was only proven that he killed two people, and he always claimed that the second victim, the owner of a hardware store, was an accidental shooting. And that was Bernice Warden, whose son Frank was a partner in their family owned operation, and Frank was a constable and also found some of the body parts out there. And they found, back to that comment a few minutes ago, as being a hunter, Ed, I guess, good or bad, knew how to dress a deer, and he dressed bodies, and he was able to skin them and gut them out, and that's where the unmentionables come in. And so they did find certain parts of people scattered around the home, and that's what the police just the first officers in the scene just went outside and just had a terrible time dealing with that, and they live with that for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and they
shocking.
And of course, he was a loner, kind of, so there was no – people didn't just stop in at his home.
Well, unfortunately – well, they did, yeah. A lot of neighborhood kids would come by because he did a lot of hunting with them. And, hey, come on, Ed, let's go hunting, or come in. And he'd sometimes have supper with them, or, of course, the neighbors would invite him over for dinner. And nobody really paid much attention, because there was only one room he kind of allowed them to go into. And afterwards, some kids remembered, they were like shrunken heads. But Ed always said they were from friends who served in World War II, and they were from New Guinea or something like that. So he always had a story, and to make up for that. And they didn't get into the rest of the home, where got lampshades and upholstery and all the other grim stuff. And there was one room that was still in quite pristine condition, and that was Augusta Gein's sitting in room and bedroom that hadn't been disturbed in whatever long 20-some years since her death. And it was which led to the Robert Black's marvelous story about Psycho, where the mother was Well, I won't spoil the story for anybody who wants to read the book, but that leads
or see
into,
the movie.
Yeah. Oh, that was a scare. Yeah.
I can't remember ever being more scared in a movie in my whole life than that one.
That set the tone. That was the icon movie for that, and it's imagination that plays off of that, and often. That's the most important thing for a writer to capture that, and I think the author did a marvelous job with that.
Well, I remember that it led to the purchase of a lot of shower curtains with either see-through holes or completely see-through shower curtains.
Yep. I can imagine it did. Just like the movie Jaws, nobody wanted to go even swimming in their bathtub after that. So.
Right. Corrine in Richland Center. Your turn. Hi, Corrine.
Yes, I watch a lot of cold case files, and believe me, it shocks me to know that the people out there who have been killers and running around for 30 to 50 years and they're solving them. Now, I'd like to see this man write a book about cops who have gone down, who, you know, just Wisconsin alone will be enough. So get on that one, please.
Cops that have gone bad?
Well, that could be. I think just this past week, an officer in, where was it? Green Bay or somewhere, was accused of attempting to murder his wife in a traffic accident. I was on the road, so I didn't catch all that. But unfortunately, no matter what you are, a banker, a butcher, baker, candlestick maker, radio announcer, whatever, things go kapooey sometimes.
John in Lake Geneva, your turn now. Hi, John.
Afternoon, gentlemen. Just a quick story. A private duty nurse years ago, and took care of a quad lady in Milwaukee here, and she visited often with John Wayne Gacy years ago, and I guess the strange thing to me was even after everything that happened with him, she still believed he was innocent, and he would apparently come up and take her to a donut shop in Milwaukee, and they'd spend hours together, and he would read the Bible and do different things, volunteer time, and I guess. Well, what I was more shocked by is just the kind of how people stand by some of these monsters, I guess, and still profess their innocence, even though we know they're guilty. So I guess I could never understand her point of view of when she'd say what a great guy he was, and even though he was he was convicted obviously and admitted to it, she still never believed he was capable of doing all that.
And again, John Wayne Gacy was, explain that.
Yeah, he was a killer in Chicago area who had bodies of young boys and young men in his backyard and under his porch and in his basement and under the garage. I can't remember the number. It was 20 or so. It was really horrendous. And some of the investigators and the DA, Cook County, helped in the Dahmer case. They came up and gave suggestions on how to deal with a mass murderer like that. And why people still... don't believe, well, that's sometimes these killers are so slick, as I mentioned before. They are smooth, and they can worm their way into somebody's psyche, and especially a needy person might feel that they'll protect them, they'll help them. That's why sometimes, these jailhouse marriages might be a reason for that. They have a correspondence going back and forth, and emotion gets out of hand.
Thanks, John, for calling. Sue in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Sue.
Good day to you. I wanted to tell you a short story about a murder that occurred in the family that I know. Now, this occurred in the late 1930s or the early 1940s. There was this large family of brothers and sisters, all of whom produced many children, and which was fortunate because most of them were farmers. But one of the group only produced daughters, two of them. So this farm family with two daughters who were made to work like slaves. The father was too cheap to hire farmhands, because he had a wife and at least two daughters, he could expect and did expect that they would do all the farm work with him. And when these daughters, who were just miserably treated, as they grew, they both said that they would never expect their own children to work ever as hard as they had been expected to work, and half the time with very low nutritional contents. Anyway, one of them did marry a neighboring farmer, had two or three children of her own, and were tragically murdered by one of their own children. And it was true, they never did expect their two children, there are three children, actually, to do anything. They so had such terrible remembrances of how they were forced to work like slaves And this young woman who grew up with her own family was tragically murdered with her husband by one of her teenagers whom she had never expected to do anything. And everybody in the family always said that that was a case of a murder occurring in the wrong generation, that if any murder would ever have occurred, it would have occurred in that first generation by those same daughters who had been tragically worked like slaves. Mm. So I would like to, this happened in Columbia County, and I would like to do research and perhaps evolve all of these facts into a novel. And I'm wondering, do you think it's, it would be the Columbia County Sheriff's Department that I that would be able to provide me with some information?
Well, a good place to start, and researching this particular book might be a case in point. We had 64 pages of footnotes and 42 yeah. pages of bibliography. Go to your local newspaper and find the record of the trial, the murder, and that's a good place to start. And I'm sure your local historical society would be good. The state historical society might have something. I'm not too sure about the police records. They'd probably be stored someplace. Yeah. You wouldn't have them in a contemporary file, I'm sure. But start with the newspapers, because that's the stuff of history. That's your first leg. So as a journalist, I always advocate people kind of read, because you're going to be reading history in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, or whatever it is, because that's the first step that's always good to take and research and double-check facts and go back over things and try to find a second opinion or second source to double-check everything. And then you'll come out with a really good story. It sounds like a fascinating tale you might have going here for
you. Yeah, it does. Thank you very much, Sue, for calling. Good luck with your story. And Dave and Augusta is on next. Dave, hi to you.
Hi again, Larry. I used to bartend in a little town called Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and one of the regulars used to come in there every day. His name was Edmund Shy. He was a man who purchased the Ed Gein property in 1957, shortly after the murders.
Mm-hmm.
He told me that he had that house purposely set on fire and destroyed without calling the fire department. And just to get rid of the onlookers and the curious seekers. But I believe that was, well, of course, that was, you know, 50 years ago. But he has since passed away. I think the property was for sale on eBay, if I remember correctly, and I don't know if it was sold.
Yeah, there's an interest. You've covered some of that in your book, actually, Martin.
Yeah, and whether or not this gentleman burned down the building, I don't think that was ever proven. And, of course, it was a so-called act of God and whatever. They never really determined that. But for a while, the sheriff's department had to post deputies out there because of the curious would keep driving past. And kind of funny to say, the frat boys from Madison wanted to come up and have keg parties on the front porch. And they had to shag those guys off all the time. And when right before there was going to be an auction of Gein's property, the building did burn. And when Ed was told about this when he was imprisoned, he just said, just as well. And he wouldn't say any more about it. But Ed's truck was auctioned off, and it became hauling junk for a local a junk dealer. His car was taken and used in a carnival for a little while. And it was just kind of really interesting what ever happened to a lot of that stuff. And back to Jeffrey Dahmer again, to make a quick leap, to prevent that from happening, some local business people purchased all of Dahmer's stuff and it was destroyed. And they took care of that.
It was kind of expensive. It was like $400,000.
Right. They just wanted to get rid of the whole thing, and just so nobody would use that for ill-gotten gains or to pander, I guess, pandering. It's just unconscionable to do something like that.
Yeah, that's for sure. Tom and Rhinelander, it's your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm enjoying the show. When I was growing up, Ed Gein, as I always heard him called, was really part of Wisconsin lore. My parents would always say, don't stay out too late at night or Ed Gein is going to get you. And when I was in college, a friend took care of him in his dotage at Mendota, and she said that he was just kind of a doddering old man then and seemed harmless. But my question is, when I was growing up, it was always Ed Gein, and somewhere along the way, pronunciation switched to Gein. Having studied German, I know that the correct pronunciation would be Gein, but I'm wondering how he pronounced it.
To be honest, I really don't know personally how he did say it. My last name is German too, Hens, and I've had Heinz, Hens, Heinz, all sorts of things. So it just maybe who knows, the vernacular can be twisted. And to be honest, I don't know how he actually pronounced his name.
Yeah, but you do hear, you heard a lot of Gein, or, you know, it's tomato and tomato kind of thing, you know, Gein or Gein.
Right, so I guess you can go with whatever you feel comfortable with.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Martin, and here I was pronouncing your name Hintz, so you like to pronounce it Heinz.
No, Hintz is fine.
Hintz is fine? Okay, well, good.
Right on. We're doing fine.
Well, you have some points that you make sort of near the in part of your book, and one of them has to do with sort of parent-child relationships and saying goodbye and things of that nature.
Well, it's so important to be aware of what's going on around you, and since you know, you read these really tragic, sad stories of these young girls or young guys who kind of wander off and don't pay attention to their surroundings. And Mike McCann, the DA of Milwaukee County for many years, always said, say goodbye to your kid every day. You know, love them, because you never know if they might be coming back. And not to be grim or you know, whatever, it's a serious thing. You don't know what's going to happen. It could be a traffic accident, too. Always significant other. It's, you only have one life to lead. You only have one child, one spouse, and to treat everybody with respect and love, because you don't know if they're coming back. And it gets back to everybody's got to be responsible for themselves too.
Joe in Madison is online. Joe, hi to you.
Hi, gentlemen. Earlier you were talking about you know, Jeffrey Dahmer being one of the 100 most intriguing people.
Yeah.
And I was running around kids and stuff, so I didn't catch all of it. But I think what they said about why he was one of the most intriguing people is because he became a born-again Christian afterwards, once he served his prison sentence prior to his death. And I think that's why, because there was a turnaround.
Well, might be. A lot of people reform, and that may be one of the many reasons why he's intriguing. He would have been intriguing even if he didn't come to realization of a spiritual being. You know, people do that, but he's intriguing still on his own, just because of their act and the horror of it all.
And you know, we've zeroed in, Martin, on a few people names here, but you cover other than Ed Gein or Gein and Jeffrey Dahmer, there are several other people that are stories that are kind of featured that are some of them grim.
Well, we went back, not just contemporary stories, and I guess Gein 1950s I guess is contemporary, but as far back as 1914, where out of Taliesin, where Frank Lloyd Wright's cook killed seven people, including Wright's mistress and her two children, and that was right at the outbreak of World War I. And apparently there might have been some ethnic slurs tossed around. The cook was a black man from Barbados, it was believed anyway. And there might have been some slurs back and forth, and there were some difficulties. And so he set fire to the house. The workman ran out, and he nailed him with a hatchet. So that was pretty bad. And they had to haul him off, and he died in the local jail. He had had some mercuric acid that he drank, and he eventually died after about a month. And so that case was pretty terrible. And that was the same year that the Geins moved from La Crosse to Plainfield, 1914. So that's a bit of a funny link, but there you go. And then we went to 1917 in Milwaukee, where an anarchist, it's believed, blew up the Milwaukee police station, killed 10 people, 9 officers and a civilian. That was the largest loss of police life until 9/11. Right in our own Milwaukee. And they never did find who did that, but it was a lot of labor agitation, immigration questions, a lot of things, kind of a little foreshadowing of what we have right now. Overblown patriotism, things like this. If you don't belong, you know, don't live here, get out. You know, if you're not, don't love it, like it here, you know, go away. And so 1914, 1917, all the way up to contemporary times.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, it's an interesting book and fascinating stories, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today to talk about it.
Well, it's my great pleasure, and next time we can talk cheese.
Next time we'll talk cheese. Martin Hintz, our guest today. Today, though, we were talking about his book, Got Murder, The Shocking Story of Wisconsin's Notorious Killers. Again, it's published by Trails Books, and so you can get it at any of your bookstores. Go to your local bookstore and you can order a copy, or you can go online to trailsbooks.com, I'm sure of that, and order from there as well. But just stop by your local bookstore and take a look at a copy. pleased to have him with us. And just to let you know, tomorrow we'll be talking with Lloyd Spencer Davis of New Zealand, penguin biologist and documentary filmmaker, and Tom Sinclair from the University of Wisconsin. They'll be visiting with us. And then we'll also visit with Jeff Wells, ornithologist and author of The Birders Conservation Handbook, 100 North American Birds at Risk. Stay with us here on the Ideas Net.